Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. You can get more information on the podcast and see more content and episodes at the website dsmsports.net. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at njh287. Got a really good show for you guys tonight. We're going to be talking to Brian Berger. He is the host and creator of Sports Business Radio, the longest-running sports business podcast and a big inspiration to myself. He's also the head of a sports PR firm called Everything is on the Record and the founder and CEO of the Sports PR Summit, a really great event. And the next Sports PR Summit is coming up on May 17th, and it's being hosted at the Players Tribune. So go to sportsprsummit.com and get in touch, and you can get an invite to that awesome event. We're going to be talking to him all about sports PR. He's seen a lot throughout his career and offers a lot of great insight into how the space has really evolved in the recent past. But first, we have this episode's helpful tool. And this episode's helpful tool is all about infographic creation. Infographics have been around for a little while now. We're starting to see them become more and more popular still. And even better, we're starting to see sponsors start to pay to get their logo on them or to pay to help produce them, whether it's an IBM or even a more consumer-facing sponsor that is trying to get their name out there with these kinds of engaging pieces of content. Of course, it takes a lot of skill to make a good infographic, but today's helpful tool is a free, easy tool, one of a few out there that we've talked about that really makes it easy to build an infographic. It's called easel.ly, easel.ly. It's a freemium tool, so there's obviously more you can access with a pro account, but there's still a ton you can do with a free account. There's a lot of really good templates you can use that are visually appealing, easy to play with, easy to customize even, and add in any information you want to add in, whether it's statistics, of course, or factoids, and really tell that story and build that engaging infographic to help your fans and to engage your fans and give them something shareable. In addition, you can also build your own. You can upload images, play with different text effects, play with different backgrounds, combine your own images with templates that they already have, and even see how it looks with a presentation mode. You can save and download. You can embed it on a website. Really a ton of really easy, cool tools to build out an infographic. And of course, if you want to shell out the additional money, you can get a pro account where you'll have access to even more features and templates that they provide. But even so, the free account offers a lot of great tools that can have you looking like an infographic pro in no time. So if you're trying to look for more ways to get more value out of your content, create more engaging content pieces, and also, again, create content that sponsors may want to be a part of, check out easel.ly and start building out some infographics and see what works, see what your fans enjoy. Maybe it's numbers, maybe it's storytelling, maybe it's a combination thereof, but infographics seem like they're here to stay, and it's a matter of you getting good enough to make them, and it doesn't take years and years of Photoshop skills and study when you have a great easy tool out there like easel.ly. So go ahead and give it a shot. Again, great free stuff. Can build an infographic, customize it, choose from templates, and I think you'll have a little fun with it. All right, that's this episode's helpful tool. Check it out. Build your own infographic. Share it with me on Twitter at njh287, and give it a go. easel.ly, easel.ly. All right, that's this episode's helpful tool. We'll be right back for a really good chat coming up with Brian Berger. All right, that was this episode's helpful tool. It's called easel.ly, a handy little infographic creator. And our guest tonight might know a little about infographics. He's spent an entire career really in PR and the sports world and has probably seen it change from basic newspaper clippings to infographics and videos today. We're really happy to have Brian Berger on the podcast, the founder and CEO of Sports PR Summit, partner and founder of Everything is on the Record, as well as the host and creator of a great sports business podcast called Sports Business Radio. Welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Neil. Really excited to be here.
Brian, really feeling privileged to be able to talk to you on the podcast this evening. I've told you before in person that you've been an inspiration for me for this podcast, and you're someone that's been in the sports PR field for a really long time and is a seasoned veteran, so to speak, even at your relatively young age. So I know we're going to have a great conversation and looking forward to it.
Yeah, I was going to say you're making me feel old with all of these nice compliments.
Hey, well, the speed at which things change these days, you know, a year or two can feel like a decade, you know, last century, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Well, Brian, before we get into the meat of the discussion today, you have a very impressive background. You've made a lot of yourself already, and so give our listeners an idea of your career path, how you came up, getting experience while you were in college, getting started with the Portland Trailblazers, and building yourself to where you are today, as well as any tips along the way.
I'll try and go with the Reader's Digest version so I don't bore the listeners. But I attended Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, and it was just an incredible experience. And one of the reasons I went there is they have one of the best broadcast schools in the country, and that really attracted me there. Their student radio station, KXLU, is one of the best in the country. I'd put it on par with the program at Syracuse. And I wanted to be a broadcaster for the basketball and baseball teams at Loyola. And you get to travel with the teams, and as luck would have it, the basketball team was nationally ranked and featured Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble, and Paul Westhead was the coach, and the team averaged about 122 points a game. So it was run and gun and a lot of fun. Unfortunately, during my junior year, March 4th, 1990, a day I'll never forget, I was courtside calling the game with my partner Keith Foreman, and Hank Gathers collapsed and later died.
Wow.
During the West Coast Conference tournament. So that was really hard for everyone, and especially for us, because, you know, here we are students, and someone drops dead in front of you, and, you know, when you're in college, you don't really think of your own mortality, and it was just a real crazy experience. But the team's response after that, and it's well documented, the iconic left-handed free throws of Bo Kimble, and it was just an incredible run and wave of emotion. So I know we'll talk about some of my favorite memories, but that's definitely up there in you know, my life. So I interned at KTLA. I had a chance to do some really great internships being in Los Angeles, movie studios, and learn a lot about the broadcasting industry. I left there, and I started as an intern with the Portland Trail Blazers, making $500 a month. And fortunately, I had some friends in Portland that took me in because I couldn't live on $500 a month. And I did everything from getting people coffee to pulling the cable of camera people to, you know, sitting in on any meeting that they'd let me attend. And after about a year, I turned it into a full-time job. And I rose through the ranks of the Blazers and did event coordination, which was great background for me. And then I moved into PR and marketing. And, you know, one of my fun jobs with the Blazers was we built the Rose Garden Arena, which is now the Moda Center, in 1995, and I traveled all over the country and looked at venues and got to help with the grand opening of the venue and what that looked like. And it was a lot of fun. After being at the Blazers for 6.5 years, I kind of felt like I had reached my ceiling on some things and wanted to try to be an entrepreneur and start my own company, which I had always wanted to do. So I was 28 years old, and I wasn't married, didn't have a child, and I felt like if I'm going to take a risk, now is the time to do it. So I started my own boutique PR firm. I took on clients like Nike. Brian Grant, who used to play for the Blazers and several other teams, was one of my clients, and, you know, tremendous athlete and really nice guy, and we did some fun stuff together.
So really leveraging the relationships that you were able to build while you were with the Blazers to some degree?
I did. Yeah, I did. And, you know, it was terrific because I wasn't calling as, you know, PR person with the Blazers or the Rose Garden Arena anymore. And people still had faith in me to guide them, you know, as a public relations consultant or expert. And I worked on some really cool projects for Nike and the Jordan brand and, you know, a number of different companies. And being based in Portland was great because I had close proximity to Nike and Adidas and Wieden and Kennedy and some of those types of companies. So, you know, I still have my boutique PR firm 17 years later. I've added a few other things, as you mentioned, to the portfolio. I launched Sports Business Radio in 2004 and, you know, thought there was a need for a more intelligent sports conversation. And also, you know, in my iPhone, I had some good contacts, owners, agents, athletes that I had built relationships with over the years that I thought would make for interesting guests. And many of those people have appeared. And then I started Everything Is on the Record in 2007 with Lee Weinstein, who was the head of USPR for Nike for 15 years. And he's tremendous and just, you know, someone that I've always looked at as a mentor and someone who does such a great job. So it's been good working with him. And then we've added Rick Bucher, who formerly with ESPN, now at the Bleacher Report, as a partner. So we work with a lot of teams and brands and CEOs, politicians, even Hollywood movie directors to help them with their dealings with the media. But you know, now teams hire us and they really want us to talk to the athletes and the executives about social media. So I'd say it used to be 80% focus on media training and 20% on social media. That's probably flipped now to where they want us to spend 80% of the time working with the athletes and the CEOs on social media and 20% on media. So it's really interesting, you know, that so many people are wanting to educate their athletes and executives on that. You know, one tweet can ruin your brand and the ripple effect it has on the brands that you're tied to. And, you know, we've just seen so much, like, in the last year, right, on with Hulk Hogan and Ariana Grande and Donald Sterling and Ray Rice, where an audio, audio recording or a video or something that's posted on social media gets someone in trouble and it ruins their brand. So, you know, that's what Everything Is on the Record does. And then in 2013, we launched the Sports PR Summit, which brings together 125 or so senior executives from PR and social media space. We've done the event in New York. We've been at the MLB Fan Cave. We were at Sports Illustrated this last year, and we just announced that we're going to be at the Players Tribune coming up in 2016 in May. So that's been, you know, maybe my signature thing that I've done. I'm just, you know, I always say I'm the dumbest guy in that room when we have that event because there's some really smart people in that room and our panelists are incredible and our steering committee is incredible. So it's a great day of learning and networking.
Wow, I could just pick your brain on so much of what you just talked about there. You've come such a long way from getting coffee as a Blazers intern, but just, you know, really impressive, I think, for, you know, getting involved early on at LMU, taking the initiative to get into broadcasting, gaining experience by calling those basketball games and ending up you know, a part of history there at the Hank Gathers game, unfortunately, and learning from that and, you know, using relationships and coming up with that menial job with the Blazers. It's just, and there's so much that I think students can learn from your experience and getting that experience, being proactive early on, as well as you know, not being beneath the job. That's something that's always coming across with guests on the podcast is, to, you know, get your foot in the door and work your way up from there and build relationships. And even years ago when you were with the Blazers, it was still all about relationships just like it is today. And I think there's a lot to learn from your background.
Yeah, I think if you go into something thinking you're above a certain job, it's a big mistake. You know, whether it was when I was getting coffee for people or pulling, you know, camera cable when I was an intern with the Blazers or even, you know, at the Sports PR Summit. If I have to grab the mic and do the crowd mic or if I have to, you know, do some catering or help someone with something, like, you know, I always joke with people, I'm the president and founder, but I'm also like the janitor and the AV guy and the event coordinator. And, you know, you wear a lot of different hats when you're an entrepreneur, but it's a lot of fun. And, you know, in school, you're sitting back on, am I ever going to use this for anything, you know, this class or this knowledge? Or it's amazing how much of what you learned in the past does come out to help you later in life in some way, shape, or form.
Totally. And I guess before we get into the rest of the discussion, when you started Sportsman's Radio back in 2004, you said, did you even know what a podcast was? I think some people are still know what podcasts are.
So it's interesting. We started in 2004, first guest out of the box, which gave us a lot of credibility, was NBA Commissioner David Stern, who, you know, appeared with me 9 times, ooh, including his last interview that he did with me, I think it was January of 2014. It was the week he retired. I was the person who got to do the last full-length interview with him. So That got more listens than any interview I've ever done in the 11 years of sports business radio. So, but it gave us a lot of credibility. Podcasts didn't actually start on iTunes until 2006. So we were on the air for 2 years, and then podcasting came along. And I have a business partner named Josh Blank, who is kind of like our technical guru. And he said, hey, we should be podcasting the shows. And I was like, okay, because, you know, we're on the radio. And I'm like, well, why do we need to podcast, too? We're on the radio. And he's like, well, because it will expand the audience. And, you know, if people can't listen live, they can now listen on demand. So I was like, okay. So we bought into that early. And if you go onto iTunes now, I mean, there's over 300 podcasts that we've posted on there since 2006, and I think it's pretty good content. I'm very proud of it. But yeah, I didn't know what podcasting was until my partner Josh introduced me to it, and I certainly know what it is now, and big believer in podcasting, and think, you know, going forward, radio will always exist, but podcasting with people's busy schedules and also mobile devices, and, you know, they're going to start making podcasting more accessible via cars and building those apps into the cars, I think it's going to be a much more acceptable form of consuming audio.
Oh, most definitely. Like you said, it's all about the on-demand content. And for what it's worth, at the very least, without that podcast, you and I would not probably not know each other today. So we can at least be thankful for that.
Yes, definitely.
So let's start out talking a little bit about how you've managed to stay ahead of the curve when it comes to sports PR. You talked about how it really, transitioned from traditional media to more social media, and the speed, the velocity, the transparency of it all. How do you manage to, especially when you stepped away from the Blazers, keep up with all the latest trends and practices while you're counseling clients who are looking to you to keep them up to date?
You know, there's a lot of tricks to the trade, but at the end of the day, I think PR comes down to a few things. One is relationships. So, you know, it's maintaining relationships with the media. So when you call them on something, they know that, A, you're going to deliver a client. So, like, if I call someone and say, hey, I've got a client and I'm going to arrange for an interview, they know they can trust me to deliver on that. I mean, I wear the other hat is the host of Sports Business Radio, and I can't tell you how many times I probably get 30 to 40 emails a day from people pitching me guests on Sports Business Radio. And so many times I followed up and said, okay, let's set something up, and the PR person can't deliver. So that's like rule number one. Just if you pitch something, deliver on what you pitch. And sure, there's circumstances where you need to reschedule, but I can't tell you how many people I don't think ever had any ability to deliver what they were pitching. So I say back to them, like, hey, I'm in PR too. Like, why are you even pitching me on this if you can't deliver the goods, so to speak? So relationships are big, and I've built, you know, over 20 years, some really good relationships with reporters that I've dealt with over the years. And then there's the relationship with your client. And, you know, your client is placing a lot of trust in you, and they're placing their image in your hands. And if someone's in crises, they're saying, help me get out of this in a, you know, as graceful a manner as possible. And, you know, with social media, sometimes people are saying, hey, I need to be branded a certain way, or can you help me learn this because I don't know it very well. There's still a lot of clients out there that don't understand the social media space. They don't understand, you know, the cadence in which you should post, the voice that you should use when you're posting, the personality you should have when you're posting. So, you know, those are just some fundamentals. Again, I don't think it's rocket science. I think it's having the personality and, you know, continuing to build those relationships, finding a reason to stay in touch with a certain reporter, even if you haven't talked to them for a while, and not just calling them when you need something, but calling them, you know, when you may be able to be helpful to them.
And at the end of the day, you talk about pitching ideas and stories. I mean, I think that's the key term, is it's storytelling. We're still in the business of telling stories. Is it just the medium has changed a little bit with social media, or is it really changing the way that we go about presenting content, presenting media at the end of the day?
The storytelling, in my opinion, has never been harder because there's so much clutter. There's so many platforms. There's so many channels to distribute content. And how do you stand out? How do you break through the clutter? How do you remain memorable? And, you know, I think I've figured out a pretty good recipe for my clients to do that. And, you know, one is being authentic. You never want someone to be someone that they're not. But, you know, helping them find those stories. A lot of times they may not think of something that I can say to them, hey, you know, have you thought of this? And, oh, wow, that is a good story, and it does resonate. And so, you know, the storytelling, I totally agree with you, is very, very important. And, you know, I think one of the reasons I started Sports PR Summit is I sit on both sides of the fence. I'm the only person I know that sits on both the media side and the PR side. And so I wear different hats. And I know media people really well, and I know PR people really well. And naturally, there's a distrust that exists between reporters and PR people. PR people think reporters are irresponsible and shoot from the hip and tweet out information that may not be accurate. And media people think PR people are protecting the kingdom, they have something to hide, they're not telling the truth, they're not giving the access that they need to you know, athletes or coaches or executives. So it's trying to bring those two sides together for conversations at least once a year at our event and, you know, letting them have candid conversations and say, okay, here's what you can do to work better with me moving forward. And there's a better understanding from PR people and reporters of each other's worlds leading the event. You know, we were at Sports Illustrated, and John Wartime, the executive editor, and Chris Stone, the managing editor, and Richard Deitch were on a panel. And I thought they did a great job of, you know, being politically correct, but also being very candid with our PR attendees and letting them know, like, here are some clues for how you can pitch us better, and here's how you can come up with stories that will resonate with us. And, you know, those conversations just don't take place. And again, that's one of the things I'm most proud of, is that they are taking place at the Sports PR Summit.
How much has that media and PR relationship really evolved and changed over the last, you know, decade or so? I mean, before, it was almost the teams and the PR folks had to rely, I guess, or had a more dependent relationship on the media, where, you know, we want X, Y, and Z to get out to the masses. We have to go through the USA Today's or the local paper or the ESPNs of the world, and now it's, you know, we have the content. You need us more than we need you, and we can really become our own media. We don't need you as much. Is that something that's really playing out, and how is that affecting the relationships?
I think it's a mix still. You know, so, yeah, it used to be back in the day when I worked at the Blazers, you know, you wanted to be in the Oregonian, and you wanted to be in Sports Illustrated, and you know, there wasn't really the internet, and there certainly wasn't social media. So you were dependent on the media to tell your stories. Now, many teams, many leagues, many brands, I look at a brand like Red Bull, they've built platforms to tell their own stories. But they still love to be featured in Sports Illustrated. They still love a good feature on the Players Tribune or USA Today. There's a medium. I don't think you can still say, like, hey, we're 100% good just with content on our own platforms and, you know, nothing in the media. But I think more and more teams and leagues and brands have recognized that, you know, especially the newspapers, their influence and their, you know, man and woman power have decreased. It's an industry that doesn't have the resources that it had 15, 20, 25 years ago. So you've got to do both. And that's what I advise my clients, too, is build your own platforms. That's what's sustainable long-term. And when I say platforms, your website, your social media platforms, you know, do you have video channels, audio channels, all those things. Build those, feed that beast, but still work with the media. And if someone wants to do a feature on you, then, you know, let's find a way to make that successful too.
So are we almost reaching an inflection point where the media is eventually going to lose that power of dissemination, that credibility, where they really are almost not so much on hands and knees begging, but in the position where they really need to rely on teams to give them the access, give them the content, so that they can feed those channels and feed their following and their fans? Or are we still always going to have at least some influence from the media being that disseminator?
Oh, I think we'll always have influence from the media being the disseminator, whether it's sports or politics. I mean, look, it's political season right now, and Fox and CNN and CNBC and everyone's ramping up the rhetoric. And, you know, this is a time where they get a lot of viewers and eyeballs on their TV stations and their website. And, you know, in sports, I think it's the same thing. I think the media will always have a role. It's certainly changing. And, you know, obviously we've seen the shift to digital, and We've seen reporters who are old school have to figure out, how do I tweet, and how do I post on Instagram, and how do I, you know, shoot video, and how do I edit, and, you know, those are all things that it needs to be in a reporter's tool belt, where it used to be sometimes you just show up with your pad of paper and your pen, and you did the interview, and, you know, you came back and you wrote your story or your column, and so things are changing, but, you know, I'm not ready to say, oh, the mainstream media is on their hands and knees begging for stories. I think they're still very much a player in all of this and very powerful, and I think, you know, if you look at what the Players Tribune is doing, I love what they're doing because it's a mixture of the two. So, you know, you're hearing firsthand from athletes and from coaches, and, you know, it's very candid and very insightful, and I just think it's brilliant what they're doing. And, you know, you still see, like, a guy like Steve Nash, he makes his retirement announcement on the Players Tribune. Really cool pictures and, you know, written in his voice, and but he still does interviews with other outlets about his career. It's not like he just said, okay, I'm only talking to the Players Tribune. I'm not going to talk to Sports Illustrated or USA Today or ESPN. So, you know, as a publicist, you want your clients to be able to tell different stories on different platforms, and, you know, I still think that exists today.
Are players now more than ever cognizant of the value of their content, knowing that, hey, you know what, my quotes, my story – can sell 1,000 papers or get 1,000 clicks to your website, and is now I'm more cognizant of what I do with my story, what I do with the content coming out of my mouth, so that if I do want to, you know, be my own media source, you know, thinking, I guess, back to maybe Shaq sort of being maybe the early pioneer in this area, is that something that's a relatively recent phenomenon, or do you feel like your clients, that players out there, athletes out there, are more aware than ever that the content I'm creating just by talking and just by playing the game every day is something that holds great value?
I think they are. I think what most of the athletes have put an investment in is their own social media platforms. So, you know, I'll give you an example. I'm based in Portland, and Damian Lillard is the point guard for the Portland Trailblazers, and, you know, we're the 24th biggest media market, and so this isn't a big media market. But Damian Lillard just signed a lucrative deal with Adidas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons he did that is because he's brilliant on social media. So what he's done is he's removed the localness of being a player in Portland, Oregon. Adidas feels like he can sell shoes all over the world. They take him to Asia, and, you know, he's known throughout the world. And one of the reasons is he's got a great personality on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. He really knows how to engage with fans. And, you know, I tell my clients now, there used to be the Q rating, where if a company was going to hire you for, you know, being a spokesperson or an endorser, they want to see how recognizable your name is before they hire you, because if no one knows who you are, then they're not going to hire you. Well, the new Q rating is your social media following. Mm-hmm. And if you can say, well, I've got 1 million followers, or I've got, you know, 34 million followers, like Kim Kardashian, who I'm not a big fan of, but 34 million followers will get people to engage her in business because they know she can reach a lot of people with one tweet or one Instagram post. So, you know, that's what I think athletes are looking at, is they're saying, how can I build my own social platform so if I want an endorsement deal, or if I want to promote my charitable work and foundation, or even when I retire and I still want to be relevant, I've invested in that, and it's built up to a point where I'm still going to be relevant.
If only we could look back and wonder how many Twitter followers or Facebook fans that a Joe Namath or a Joe DiMaggio would have had when they were pitching products back in the day.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, Michael Jordan, and, you know, it's interesting. Like, I look at someone like Derek Jeter, and he's on Facebook, but he's not on Twitter. And, you know, if I were sitting down with Derek Jeter, I would say, hey, you know, why aren't you on Twitter? You've seen your success on Facebook. You have great stories to tell as the founder or co-founder of the Players Tribune. Like, that could be a real asset for you. I haven't sat down with him. I don't know why he's not on Twitter. But, you know, I think if you're an athlete or a celebrity, you have to look at those things. You look at someone like Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning is not on social media. Well, when he retires, I'm sure he's still going to make a lot of money as a broadcaster or you know, whatever else he wants to do, but maybe he'll want to be relevant. Kobe Bryant has entered the social media arena kind of later in his career. Tiger Woods didn't get on there at the beginning, and now has been on there, and really if he has news to talk about, whether it's an injury or anything else, you know, the first place he goes is his social media platform. So I think athletes are warming up to the fact that this can be a real tool for me, and not as much, oh, I'm afraid to engage, I'm afraid if I get on there. You know, like you hear Charles Barkley say, I would be bad on Twitter. Well, right. He might be the one guy where he probably wouldn't be great on Twitter, because he would probably say something that you know, might rub someone the wrong way or get him in trouble. But for the most part, I think it's a great tool, and it's something that's very sustainable.
Oh, very true. I mean, it as you spoke to, it's a brand building tool as well as a way to control the message, like Tiger Woods does when he wants to go out there and set the story straight, so to speak. Let's pivot really briefly, though. Having a great conversation with Brian Berger, founder of Sports PR Sub and CEO, also the host and creator of Sports Business Radio, having a great talk. Tell me a little about, I did have a good conversation with TJ Ansley, right up there in your neck of the woods, that works for the Blazers. And he talked a little about how they have their embedded blogger, so to speak, someone that's a sort of their in-house beat reporter. And that's something that we're seeing with teams that sort of across the board now are starting to adopt that to some degree with the NHL. Major League Baseball has definitely done so in mass. And it really speaks to how teams are trying to control the message and control the content a little more, and maybe monetizing their own content to some degree as well, and getting all the traffic to their site and not to, you know, the Oregonian, for example. Is that something where you're seeing teams, you think, hold their content more for the opportunity to monetize it with sponsorships, with traffic? Or is it also the other side of the coin where we want to make sure that we're putting the message out there the way we want it out there, not the way that, you know, the XYZ beat reporter might be doing it?
Yeah, I think when you're a team, you can frame the message the way you want to frame it. It doesn't mean that you don't allow media interviews or things like that. So, like, I'll give you an example. I have a client here locally that, smaller client, but I really enjoy working with them, is the Hillsboro Hops, and they're the single-A short-season affiliate of the Arizona Diamondbacks. So this week, they are sending the number one pick in the Major League Baseball draft, Dansby Swanson, who played at Vanderbilt, shortstop, really good player. They're sending him to Hillsboro to start his pro career. So he arrives, and we're going to do a media availability with him on Thursday. But before we do that availability, I'm going to have him sit down with the Hops social media people and with the website people, and he's going to do in-house interviews first. And, you know, I think what most teams want to become known as, or they want you to go to their platforms first for the best news. So, like, hey, definitely, when you want to find out about tickets, or you want to find out about an announcement, or, you know, anything like that, come to our platforms first. Doesn't mean that you still won't read them in the media at some point, but, you know, I think people are trying to, the teams have the best access, right? You're with your athletes, you're with your coaches, you're on the bus, you're at the practices, you're at batting practice, wherever you are, you have the best access, better than anyone else. So why not take advantage of that, especially as you look at the media declining, not disappearing as we just discussed, but declining, and they may not have the resources to tell your story on a regular basis. So you've still got to put content out there. I get the whole monetization of it, and, you know, as I call it, tricks for clicks with the media and with, you know, people trying to get clicks on things. But I think first and foremost, from a sports organization, or at least the people I speak with, is it's still storytelling, and it's still getting to know the players, getting to know the coaches, maybe telling some stories that the mainstream media doesn't know about, or isn't telling at all. So, you know, again, the being sustainable with your own platforms, whether you're a team, a league, a brand, or an athlete, I think it's very important.
And I think one fascinating thing to watch, too, we won't necessarily go into today, is how we're starting to see some pro teams out there even make fans aware of rumored reports. I mean, even if they're not substantiating them with any confirmation, they're saying, well, it's being reported out there, or this is being reported out there. we won't confirm anything because nothing's official, but at least they want to be that conduit, that destination for fans to get all their information about the teams.
Yeah, it's still kind of a rock and a hard place, right? So, like, you know, is NFL Network going to crucify Roger Goodell and Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson when they're the network for the league? Is MLB Network going to come down hard on, you know, steroid users? And, you know, are they going to tell us the whole truth like another outlet might? Probably not, because, you know, you can't bite the hand that feeds you. But, you know, I think they're getting better at not turning a blind eye to it and pretending it doesn't exist like some of them used to do. They're covering those stories, and, you know, they may not be covering them as in-depth as other outlets, but they're still covering the stories and not pretending that they don't exist like, again, they probably did 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You can certainly at least cover the facts and not necessarily go all Bill Simmons on the NFL as well. Before we get into this episode of Charitable Stat, though, Ryan, I did want to touch on one more subject, a couple more minutes left here before we get into this episode of Charitable Stat, and that is really the means to an end, I guess, of PR these days. I think maybe you can speak to this better than I can, being a seasoned veteran of the industry, about how really the way we've looked at how PR is successful over the last decade or so, how you guys define success 10 years ago versus how we look at it today. Is there content that's getting more clicks that ultimately leads to more sales? Is there more marketing means to it, the content, whether there's sponsors involved or other things trying to be promoted? And the idea of clickbait as well, in addition to the stories you're trying to put out there. So I guess long way of asking, how do we reconcile this idea of trying to measure the ultimate success of marketing of PR?
Well, so I think you just defined it. You know, it's got a lot more layers to it than it used to. It used to just be like, hey, do I open the newspaper and see a positive story? Yes, I do. Okay, great. That was perfect. Now, it does have, you know, am I telling stories on multiple platforms? Are they getting clicks and attention? Are we monetizing this? Are we feeding our social media platforms? You know, there's so many elements that go into it and layers that go into defining success. But, you know, at the end of the day, I still think the ultimate definition is, do I walk away feeling like that was a positive story about my brand or my product or my athlete or my coach or my league or my team or whatever it is? You know, you want people to leave with the, hey, you know, that's really cool. Like, that guy's really cool. Like, I was watching Hard Knocks tonight, and, you know, I've always admired J.J. Watt, and but I don't really know J.J. Watt. I follow him on social media and stuff like that. But I watched Hard Knocks, and I was like, you know, they had some really good stuff on him. And you saw, like, how late he stays for practice, and, you know, he signs autographs for 90 minutes, and he's a leader on that team. And, you know, I felt like at the end of the episode, and it's just episode one, I felt like, wow, I really know J.J. Watt a lot better. Now, maybe that's not the real J.J. Watt, and he was just doing that because the cameras are on. But, you know, I felt like at the end of the day, if someone watches that episode, they go, that guy's a hard worker, and, you know, he's a good teammate, and he's good to the fans. And I still think that's the defining factor for PR, is you want people to have a positive view of, you know, your brand or your team or your league or your athlete.
No, I think that's very, very well put. It's to sort of find that new paradigm these days is kind of, yes, we want to tell the best story in the best way possible, but it doesn't mean as much if people don't actually see it. So it's about finding a way to present those stories, leaving people with positive feelings, but still presenting them in a way that is entertaining, compelling enough to get the clicks, to get the views, to get the viewers, I guess.
Well, and one of the reasons I've loved hosting Sports Business Radio for the last 11 years is I feel like there's an art to bringing people's stories out, and I feel like there's an art to the interview, and I put a lot of research into each interview that I do. I would say that, you know, some of the people I patterned myself after as far as interviews go, Howard Stern, Charlie Rose, and you may laugh that I say Howard Stern, but, like, when people go onto Howard Stern's show, they always say, well, I'm not going to talk about this, this, or this, and by the time they're done with Howard Stern, they've laid down on the couch, and he's extracted all of the information from them. And I feel like when I bring someone onto Sports Business Radio, especially someone who's really noteworthy, that I, you know, lay them down on the couch and I make them feel comfortable and I extract the information and I bring out their stories. I mean, when I had Mark Cuban on and we talked about how when he was at Indiana University as a student, he sold powdered milk as his first job and he taught disco dancing lessons to co-eds. He loved the fact that I did that research. He gets asked the same questions over and over and over again. So the fact that I pulled those little nuggets out, he was mine the rest of the interview, and he was engaged and he lit up. You know, Jack Nicklaus, I knew he wanted to talk about his golf course design company, not just his career, not just, hey, is Tiger Woods going to break your record? And, you know, the same questions you get asked all the time. So I think, you know, it's partly the reporter's job, whether you work for a team or you're a member of the media or you're, you know, people like us. It's partly our job to do our homework and to bring out the best stories so our audience and our listeners go, I learned something. And my goal with Sports Business Radio is every single episode, I want my audience to learn from the guests or sometimes from me and have a few takeaways that they can go, wow, you know, I didn't know that before I listened to that show this week.
Oh, I love that. And it really ties together our conversation really well here as you transition to this episode of Shareable Stat. And it's really doing your homework and establishing that rapport. And ultimately, it's a form of relationship building. I mean, so you're having a conversation, and it's not just, you know, media person and subject. It really is a conversation with two people that have developed a sort of trust because you've shown that you have an interest in what they're really all about and not just to get their name on the billboard, so to speak.
That's very true. And, you know, one of the biggest mistakes I made when I first started Sports Business Radio, because keep in mind, you know, doing your own talk show is very different than what I had done previously, which was play-by-play and color commentary. So, you know, now when you're doing your own radio show where you're interviewing people, one of the biggest skills you need to have is listening. And I would go into an interview and I'd say, okay, I've got these 20 questions that I want to ask. And I would be so, like, married to those 20 questions and getting to those 20 questions that I wasn't doing a very good job of listening to the person I was interviewing. Because sometimes when you listen, the conversation will go in a different way, and it may be a better way than the questions that you had planned. So, you know, I feel like that's something that I've gotten much better at over 11 years is listening and going with the flow of the conversation and playing off of the answers of my guests, but still going in prepared with your homework done.
Oh, I love that. Great way to cap the conversation. I'll tell you what, coming up our next segment after this episode of Shareable Stat, we're going to have more with Brian Berger, and we are going to have a list of questions. Well, I'm going to make sure to listen to every single answer as we get to our Bits of Brian segment. But first, we have the episode of Shareable Stat coming right up.
Really enjoyed the chat with Brian. He has just so much knowledge, so much great experience, and it's really, of course, an exciting, ever-evolving world of sports PR that really you can talk about all day. But we'll have a little fun with Brian, get to hear some of his great anecdotes in our Bits of Brian segment coming right up. But first, we have this episode's Shareable Stat. This episode's Shareable Stat came out of NBC Sports' opening weekend of English Premier League soccer, and that is that year over year, they saw a 43% increase in their opening weekend of games for EPL. 43%. Yes, folks, soccer interest in the United States is growing, and it's not just the U.S. Women's National Team and their recent World Cup victory that's reinvigorating the sport, but the Premier League, which is considered some of the best football, soccer, in the world, is really getting popular in the United States, even when it's being played at 7 a.m. Eastern, which for a West Coaster like me, I'm not exactly ready to wake up at 4 a.m. For a game of soccer. But a lot of fans are. A lot of fans are waking up on the East Coast and having a cup of joe and watching English Premier League soccer on the NBC Sports Family Networks as those ratings increase show. So what can this do for soccer in the United States overall? How can the MLS feel about this? At the end of the day, it's yes, they love that soccer is getting more fans, but of course they much prefer that they're watching their games, the MLS games, attending their games. But you know what? As Brian will speak to later on in this podcast, it's all about getting more interest in the sport. Yes, you may not be going out to MLS games to see all the stars of the world, but you know what? A lot of stars from the EPL now are starting to come over here because they're seeing that there is a thirst for soccer and that these are markets that they can cater to. So a star like Kaká, Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, Giovanni Dos Santos, these guys who have spent their career playing in the greater international soccer markets, especially the English Premier League, as well as La Liga and the German League and the Italian League, Serie A, they're seeing that there is indeed a viable soccer market here. And as those names start to cross over and people don't realize that there's an EPL and an MLS and it's really just a bunch of great football, a bunch of great soccer being played, it truly can gain a strong foothold in the United States. And even better, sponsors can reach those soccer fans that want to operate in the soccer space. So yes, that 43% year-over-year increase in the opening week of English Premier League games on NBC Sports is not going to instantly make the MLS a lot more money or add value to their TV deal, but it does bode really well for the sport in the long term. And bodes well, of course, for NBC Sports, which recently re-upped their agreement with the EPL for another 6 years. All right, guys, that's this episode's shareable stat. 43% year-over-year increase for the opening weekend of Premier League soccer on the NBC Sports Family Networks, and it bodes well for the future soccer in the States. All right, that's this episode of Shareable Stat. We'll be right back. Have a little fun with our guest, Brian Berger, in our Bits of Brian segment.
All right, that was this episode's Shareable Stat, and it's all about how, well, the English Premier League had a great opening weekend on the NBC Family Sports Networks, and there's a reason NBC just re-upped to them for the next 6 years, And Brian, now before we get into our Bits of Brian segment, we're talking to Brian Berger, creator and host of Sports Business Radio Podcast, as well as CEO and founder of Sports PR Summit. Tell us, when you see something like a big soccer rating or a big rating, if you're looking at it from an MLS perspective and you're trying to grow the sport domestically, the league domestically, is that a good thing that the Premier League games are way up in popularity, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
No, I think it's a good thing. I think, you know, you want more people interested in soccer, and whether that's English Premier League or MLS or, you know, I have a 10-and-a-half-year-old daughter that plays soccer. I think just getting people interested in soccer is a plus, and then if you can direct them to a certain thing like English Premier League or MLS or you know, collegiate soccer or wherever it may be, I'm a big fan of Women's World Cup, and you know, here in Portland, we have the Portland Thorns who draw 17,000 fans a game. So, you know, I think it's great for soccer all the way around.
Oh, definitely. It's really interesting to see, with especially up there in Portland and the Seattle area as well, you're really seeing a growth of not just soccer fans, but even MLS fans and fans who are diehard Sounders fans or, you know, part of the Timbers fan groups. And so it's really interesting to see sort of the growth of the sport as well as the growth of just the fandom, I guess.
Yeah, I think with the Timbers and the Sounders, but excuse me, even, you know, more so the Timbers have done is they've really played to their fan base. So, you know, instead of just like bringing in a team and going, all right, we've got Major League Soccer here and we've got the players, like, they have played to what makes Portland unique. They have played to what makes Seattle unique. They have played to the long history of soccer in both of those cities. They've played to that rivalry. So yeah, I think they've done it the right way versus just, you know, you see a lot of leagues come in and they'll just be like, okay, we just got to sell tickets. And, you know, it's not authentic to the grassroots of the fans in that market. And I think here in the Pacific Northwest, Portland and Seattle have done that extremely well.
Oh, very well put, very well articulated too. Well, Brian, you survived your interview for the podcast. Are you now ready for your Bits of Brian segment?
Let's go, I'm ready.
It's a little fun. All right, maybe you might have talked about this previously already, maybe not. Number one for you, the best sports PR performance of the last 25 years, and why?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I'll give you one that's not really sports-related, and it's more recent. I loved that kid in San Francisco. And, you know, to me, if you're looking at PR and you're looking at a story that had all of the elements of a successful story. So, you know, for those people unfamiliar with Bat Kid, there was a young man who had a wish with Make-A-Wish, and he wanted to be Batman for the day. And he happened to reside in San Francisco. And literally, San Francisco transformed itself into Gotham City for one day. And he went from, you know, AT&T Ballpark and had an experience with the Giants, and he was downtown and got to ride around in the Batmobile. He saved a damsel in distress. It was on every major TV network, whether it was news or sports. It was, you know, one of the most trending topics on social media for not just a day or two, but probably for a few weeks. They're actually turning it into a movie, a major motion picture.
Oh, I did see that.
When you look at stories that resonate and things that I use as case studies for, like, all, it has all the layers to it. It has emotion. It has authenticity. You know, it has a great ending. People rallied together. It had the human spirit. Like, without sounding corny, I just thought, wow, that is a story that I will remember for a long, long time.
Oh, I love the answer, and it really did resonate with me as well, and it just conjures up so much emotion as we were all living through it kind of together, and social media helped it really play out so that we were kind of experiencing it all as one. On the other side of the coin, then, Brian, number two for you, how about the biggest sports PR flop kind of the last 25 years and why? You're just like, what were these guys thinking?
This is a hard one, too, because there's several of them. You know, the easy one would be to say how the whole Tiger Woods situation was handled. For someone who has the resources that he has to, you know, think that after the, you know, famous incident with the golf club and the car hitting the fire hydrant and all that kind of stuff, to think that they thought that it was just going to blow over and that he could, you know, kind of go into hiding for a little bit, and then when he showed his face again, that the story was just going to have gone away, is stunning. And then, you know, the press conference he did with the one camera going out and the side angle camera and the blue drape behind him, it was like a Saturday Night Live skit. So, you know, I look back, you know, on how things were handled there, and it was stunningly bad. I also, you know, I have friends in Major League Baseball, so I need to be careful here, but remember a few years ago when the All-Star game ended in a tie, and you go back and, you know, they had never had a tie. So they had the press conference with, I think it was Joe Torre and Bob Brenly. I want to say it was 2002. It was after the D-backs and Yankees had played in the World Series. And that, too, was kind of a comedy of errors because they had never dealt with that situation before. So, you know, it speaks to the fact that you've got a plan for every situation. When I work with clients on crises, they're like, that would never happen, or we're spending time on something that has a low probability. And I'm like, you know what? You have to anticipate things, and you have to plan for almost every scenario. When I worked at the Blazers and, you know, worked at the arena, and I hope I'm not giving away any, you know, trade secrets or anything, but, you know, we had the little red handbook, and it was the nuclear book. If someone calls in a bomb threat, if someone opens fire in the arena, if something goes catastrophically wrong, here's the chain of command. Here's how this is going to play out in a crisis, and you're ready for it. If you don't plan for those things and they happen, and we see this time and time again, Penn State, you know, and how that was all handled was another example. So lots of examples that I just gave you, but, you know, I think people who plan for crises and try and get out ahead of things are always the ones that are going to do a little bit better. And then don't be arrogant. Don't think that, oh, I'm Tiger Woods, or I'm the NFL, or I'm, you know, I'm so big that this story will just blow over. It's not going to blow over. Deal with it and move on. You know, you can go with the Andy Pettit playbook and say you made a mistake,
right,
or you can go, you know, with the Lance Armstrong playbook, and you saw how that turned out.
Well, cough, deflate gate, cough. As you said, there's really examples of it every day, so that's definitely plenty of fodder for that question. But that kind of leads us into our next question, I guess number three for you, Brian. How about the biggest lesson that you have for the next generation of sports PR pros?
So, have a lot of things in your utility belt. You know, build relationships, be a good writer, understand the media as it exists today, both mainstream media and, you know, self-publishing and creating content for social media platforms. Be a good face-to-face networker. Don't just link in with a million people you don't know and then never have a conversation with them. You know, it's one of the reasons, again, that I do Sports PR Summit, and I say to very senior people, hey, we all know each other via digital platforms, but how often do we get together face-to-face? And I really believe that once you get together with someone face-to-face, the dynamic changes. You remember that person. You have a deeper relationship with them. You feel more comfortable picking up the phone and calling them or emailing them. It's just a different dynamic. So don't just go to people when you need something. Bring them something. Be a hard worker. Be an authentic networker. Those are some of the tidbits of advice that I would give.
Oh, I love that. So don't just have your entire PR strategy be formed around texting, I guess, back and forth, let alone WhatsApp or Snapchat.
Exactly. Yeah, pick up the phone or go meet for coffee or, you know, don't just keep it into the, you know, the digital realm. Try and take it beyond there. And you know, look, some reporters are really busy and they won't meet you in person, but do your best. And again, I look back at my career and, you know, someone like John Wartime, who's the executive editor at Sports Illustrated, I've known him since I was at the Blazers, and he was writing for Rip City Magazine, the official publication of the Blazers. And, you know, he's done a lot of different things. I've done a lot of different things, but we've stayed in touch over 20-plus years. And, you know, he was gracious enough to host us at the Sports PR Summit at his venue in May. And you just never know when someone may pop back into the picture and be able to help you, or you may be able to help him. And, you know, that's just one example of a person that I've stayed in contact with for a long, long time.
Just a fantastic lesson and anecdote for the so-called digital natives that are now coming up in the world, I guess, in the professional ranks. Number four for you, Brian. I know superlatives are always tough for podcast guests, so maybe just the top few or the top among the top ones. The most affable athlete with whom you worked over your career?
You know, that's actually pretty easy. And I think I mentioned him earlier in the show. Brian Grant was one of my first clients, and he played for the Blazers, he played for the Lakers, played for the Miami Heat. He now has Parkinson's and has a foundation that helps people when they're diagnosed with Parkinson's. He and I had the pleasure a few years ago of going out and spending a few days with Michael J. Fox and the people who run the Michael J. Fox Foundation. So hands down, it's Brian Grant. He has one of the biggest hearts I've ever seen in an athlete. Was just a hard worker on the court. You know, maybe not the most talented guy out there, but he'd outwork anyone and was kind of that lunch pail mentality. And, you know, just a really good guy and understood, you know, when you had to deal with the media and was kind of at the beginning of the digital era, you know, with the website and social media and stuff like that. So he would be my favorite.
Love that. And some guys get it, some guys don't. Sounds like Brian Grant definitely is one that got it and was definitely good to work with. That's great to hear.
Yeah, another thing, you know, I'd say with him too is like, you know, at a certain point when you work with people for a long time, whether it's an athlete or a coach or, you know, someone else, you become friends with them. And, you know, you sincerely want to see them succeed. So, you know, I've enjoyed that part of owning my own business, too, is there's no one that's saying, hey, you know, don't get too close to that person or don't, like, you know, I feel like I have a pretty good gauge on that. And, you know, I consider Brian like a brother now, so you know, that's been one of the things that I've really liked about having my company is building those relationships.
Another repetition of the word relationships, and we cannot emphasize that enough, I think, in this episode of the Digital Social Media Sports Podcast. All right, number five for you, Brian. The most memorable sports story you've witnessed in your career, and this could be something that you were actively involved in or just witnessed as an observer, the most memorable sports story.
Okay, so there's two of them. One is what I referred to earlier, which was the Loyola Marymount basketball team that was nationally ranked. We were playing in the WCC tournament March 4th, 1990, and Hank Gathers collapsed and died on the court. And then, you know, we went and buried him in Philadelphia, very emotional week. And then, you know, we came out and just, it was an unbelievable performance in the NCAA tournament. And I'll never forget that team and the energy and emotion that they played with as they honored Hank Gathers. And They played Michigan, who was the defending national champs. And if I didn't see it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it. But Michigan was like, they were unbelievable. And they had never lost in the tournament under Steve Fisher, who was their coach. Loyola Marymount beat them 149-115. And
oh, wow.
I'm not kidding you when I tell you that, like, they could have turned around backwards from half court and thrown it behind their back and it would have gone in that day. It was just unbelievable offensive performance against a really good team, the defending national champs. So that's one story. The other is my first month on the job for the Blazers in 1992, I got to witness the NBA Finals with the Blazers and the Chicago Bulls. And then right after that, the NBA Draft was held outside of New York for the first time, so I got to work the NBA Draft. But the best part of that summer was Dream Team 1 played the Basketball Tournament of the Americas in Portland, Oregon, and that team featured Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Chris Mullin, Scottie Pippen, Charles Barkley, Pat Ewing. I mean, one of the most unbelievable collections of talent. And, Neil, I got to work, you know, closely with them, and this is back when you, like, collected quotes from players and sent them out on the AP wire after the game. There wasn't Twitter or anything like that. But one of the coolest things about that was I would sit in on some of their practices, or after practice, these guys would play games of horse that were like the Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, McDonald's commercial, where it's like off the freeway, off the scoreboard, off the... They had unbelievable games of horse, and I was in there when that was going on. So some of the behind-the-scenes stuff around Dream Team 1 is something I'll never forget.
Oh, wow. There are, I'm sure, several people that would give multiple limbs to have been able to just be a fly on the wall in those practices and those events. That's awesome. I'm jealous just hearing about it. All right, this is a tough one for you, Brian, but let's see what we can do. In 90 seconds or less, what does the term jailblazers conjure up for you?
Ooh. So, for the record, I was no longer with the Blazers when they transitioned into the jailblazers. And I was working with Brian Grant, and he was a good guy, and he actually won the J. Walter Kennedy Citizenship Award. So what it conjures up for me is, you know, there were some guys on that team that were knuckleheads, but then there were some guys that, you know, may have gotten some bad publicity, but they really weren't bad guys. Rasheed Wallace, not a bad guy. Damon Stoudemire, not a bad guy. But, you know, they made some knucklehead mistakes. Quintel Woods got pulled over, and the officer asked him for his driver's license, and he pulled out a trading card of himself. That's always one of the best stories ever. So, you know, it was an era where Bob Whitsitt, who was the GM, basically said, you know, I'm putting talent over character, and, you know, that's what you got when you did that. But Brian Grant stood out and again, won the NBA's Man of the Year award because he did some incredible things off the court. So, for my purposes, I'm not going to say I had an easy job, but when you had the one guy on the team that the city adored and was doing great things off the court, it made my job a lot easier than if everyone else in the team was also doing great things off the court in the community. So, but, you know, look, for the people who still bring that era up, the team now is phenomenal. I mean, Damian Lillard and C.J. McCollum and Myers Leonard and, you know, even the guys that just left, Wes Matthews is a wonderful guy, and Rolo, and yeah, they were all really good guys. So, you know, that era is long gone, and the thing that makes Portland different than a lot of other cities is this is the big game in town here. So they expect you to be a good citizen as well as a good athlete, and it doesn't just go for the Blazers. It also goes for the Timbers. So, you know, in L.A. or Philadelphia or New York, you can get lost a little bit, you know, if you're a knucklehead, and because there's five teams in town. But here, you know, you're kind of in the fishbowl because you're the only game in town.
And to think, you know, what social media maybe would have done to that era, I think it more just amplifies not just the bad of the jailblazers, but can also amplify the good of like a Brian Grant and get that story out there to more of the masses. So really, it's really interesting, I think, to sort of think about how social media would have affected that era for better and for worse.
Definitely. I think for that era, I think it would have definitely been worse than better. So good thing that social media didn't exist during that era.
Deadspin and TNT Sports, they would have had a field day, that's for sure.
An absolute field day. But, you know, this is what I say, and you kind of referred to this earlier. Look, what would social media, how would we look at JFK, Elvis Presley, Mickey Mantle, Joe Namath? You know, the list goes on of people who, even Michael Jordan more recently, if they had lived in the social media era that exists today, we would look at them very differently than we do. You know, now Frank Sinatra, I mean, these people were out having a good time. They were doing things that were inappropriate. And, you know, because social media didn't exist and everyone didn't have a phone on their, or a camera on their phone, you know, they got away with a lot of stuff that the people today don't get away with.
I'm going to pretend that my dad will never know that Mickey Mantle was most likely a womanizing alcoholic, perhaps, in his free time. Number eight for you, Brian. Number seven for you. How about looking at the landscape these days, the pro athlete that does the best job managing their brand, and why?
Boy, there's several of them. Again, you know, I'm in Portland, so I'll say Damian Lillard, I think, does a really nice job with his social media brand and, you know, being authentic. And, you know, he really has played to small-town Portland. He came from Weber State. I think J.J. Watt does a good job on social media. Dwayne Wade put some interesting stuff up, but I think overall he's done a pretty good job. You know, I'm not a huge LeBron fan, but I think LeBron has done a decent job. So those are just a few that I would name. You know, there's plenty of female athletes out there that do good jobs too. Maria Sharapova, I follow her, and she's always got some good stuff, and Serena does good stuff, and Alex Morgan, I think, is excellent. So, you know, those would be a few that I would name.
Yeah, excellent. At the end of the day, like you said, I think it's authenticity and really trying to develop a relationship with your fans and not just broadcasting. All right, number eight for you, Brian. Portland's known, among other things, for having a great being a great food city. So tell me, if I'm going to go visit Portland, what's the best food to get in the city?
Oh, gosh. Well, so the first thing that you're going to learn is that, like, food carts here win restaurant of the year from the local media. So food carts are synonymous with Portland. And it's not like the New York food carts. It's more, you know, you'll go to certain clusters of town and they'll have food carts. You know, they've got really good Thai food here. They have, you know, tremendous seafood here, obviously, really good organic, sustainable food. Everyone talks about Voodoo Donuts. You know, I'll throw them out there because when people come to Portland, they usually want to go to Voodoo Donuts and have a Voodoo Donut. That's kind of, you know, one of the signature things to eat when you come to Portland. So those are a few things, but this has definitely become a foodie city. And it's not New York or San Francisco, but it's not far from those cities. It is world class when it comes to food.
Well, I am set. It's a weird, it's an interesting combination, but I'm going to go grab some Thai food and finish it off with a Voodoo Donut.
There you go.
All right, last one for you, Brian, to get you out of here. One, I guess the question is, will Portland get another major pro sports team? If so, when's it going to happen, and in which sport?
So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. If it did happen, it would be the NHL. You know, when I worked for the Blazers way back when we built the what's now the Moda Center, we built it more for NHL than we did for NBA. And, you know, if you look at the sport that could come here next week, doesn't need a venue built, could slide right into the Moda Center, give them additional dates, you know, you'd be able to charge sponsors additional revenue. It just makes so much sense on a lot of levels. It would be NHL. The reason it hasn't happened, and I also know this from working for the Blazers, is Paul Allen doesn't get excited about getting on his plane and flying here for hockey games like he does for basketball. So, you know, unless he got a team for next to nothing, and he's come close to getting a few NHL teams for very, very good prices. He almost had the Pittsburgh Penguins before Mario Lemieux swooped in and bought them several years ago. I think NHL would be the next league to come here. I don't think NFL works. I don't think Major League Baseball works. I'd love to see them here. You know, there aren't many Fortune 500 companies in Portland or in Oregon, period, and there's just not the revenue here for sponsors, and there's not the base here for season tickets for, you know, three or four or five major league sports franchises. So, yeah, I think that's unfortunate. I also think our city leadership, and I've said this on the air many times, they just lack the vision. I mean, you kind of need someone who's a champion for sports in City Hall or at the state level, and we don't have that in Oregon. So, you know, unless it was NHL sliding in under the umbrella of the Moda Center and the Paul Allen Empire, I don't think we're going to have Major League Sports here for a long time.
Gotcha. Very, very good intel there for sure. All right, Brian, you survived your Bits of Brian segment. Really enjoyed that back and forth. Now your chance to take over the podcast. Give us your social media all-star follow, someone on Twitter or a blogger, whoever they are, and why they're worth following.
So I'm going to give you a few. It's hard for me to narrow it to one. I love Richard Deitch on Sports Illustrated.
Fantastic.
So at Richard Deitch. And he's just
great.
Yeah, and it was really cool. I moderated the Sports Illustrated panel that we had at Sports PR Summit. I had not met Richard before and had the opportunity to meet him. And I told him on stage, I said, if I had five people to follow on social media, you'd be in my top five. So he immediately said that I should become like his publicist or something. So, and I like his SI Media podcast that he started a few months ago. I think that's good, too. I've been listening to that. So I would recommend that for people. Maury Brown, Biz of Baseball, is great. And Maury Brown, he writes for Forbes and for USA Today. I would also recommend him. I know, you know, we have a mutual friend in Brian Polyakov at Twitter Sports.
Right.
He does PR for them. And, you know, I am always fascinated by what Twitter's doing. We saw this week the deal with the NFL. And, you know, I think it's good to follow some people who are, like, not just reporters, but also people who are kind of, like, living and breathing it within the industry. John Wartime at Sports Illustrated is another person that I would say is a good follow. So those are mine. And I enjoy following you, you know, and that's how we got to meet. I think you always put out good information. And, you know, every time I see it, it's a valuable nugget of information that I think people learn from. So I'll put you in my top five for purposes of this conversation.
I appreciate the plug, and your check is in the mail. And how about yourself, Brian? Where can we find you, as well as information on the Sports PR Summit and SB Radio on social and digital media and all over the place?
I'm easy to find. I'm in many different places. I think, you know, the main place you can find me is at SB Radio, like Sports Business Radio, on Twitter. Our website is sportsbusinessradio.com. You can find our podcast on iTunes. We just launched a channel on Audioboom. We're on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn Radio. We're, you know, a lot of places. Just search Sports Business Radio, and it's pretty easy to find us after 11 years. Sports PR Summit, go to sportsprsummit.com. And on Twitter and Instagram, it's at sportsprsummit. And then for my company, Everything is on the Record, it's just everythingisontherecord.com, and you can see what we do there.
Very easy to remember, all the above, and we'll link up to all those sites, and definitely keep an eye out for everything you're doing and listening to your podcast and you know, being ready for the next Sports PR Summit coming up in 2016 at the Players Tribune. Just a fantastic conversation with you tonight, Brian. Really appreciate you giving us the time, and best of luck moving forward with Sports PR Summit and everything else you have your hands on, because you're a busy guy.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on, Neil, and I enjoy your podcast and enjoy you on social media, and it's a pleasure to come on and be on with your loyal listeners.
Thank you so much again, Brian.
Thank you so much again to Brian Berger, creator and host of Sports Business Radio and the founder and CEO of the Sports PR Summit, for coming on the podcast. Just such great knowledge. I cannot thank him enough for his time. He is a busy guy with the Sports PR Summit coming up on May 17th. I definitely encourage you guys to check out more information at sportsprsummit.com and click on the Get in Touch form so you can get an invite to that awesome event taking place at the Players Tribune. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening. As always, you can get more information on the podcast at dsmsports.net. And follow me, your host, Neil Horowitz, at NJH287. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.